Hello, everyone, and welcome to our annual conversation on the best picture films here on The Cinephiles. I am John Roca, joined as always by director, writer, producer extraordinaire, Steve Morris. How are you, Steve?
Wow, I like my introduction. I feel really good about that. I feel like I have earned my spot as a voting member of the Cinephiles Academy.
Yeah,
to vote at the Cinephiles Award Show.
Yeah, ditto. And that's, you know, and we're not the other ones voting in the Cinephiles Award Show. Or are we? I don't think we are voting on the Cinephiles Award Show. Are we? Do our ballots count? Are they part of it since we host the show?
Don't all members of the Academy get a vote? I mean, it doesn't matter if you're president of the Academy. Nominees get to vote on their nominations. Yeah,
that's a good point. We should.
And of course, you need to get your vote in for the Cinephiles Award. And to do that, all you have to do, it doesn't cost you a dime, but you do have to go to patreon.com/thecinephiles, where you can join our free tier. And once you join, you'll find that link to vote for the Oscars, which I think voting will start 1 week before the show. So that's coming up pretty soon. That's patreon.com/thecinephiles. And guess what? If you're on that free tier, some other free stuff might head your way every once in a while. It's a pretty fun place to be.
Absolutely. Yeah, the Cinephiles Award Show, it's coming up on March 13th, the Saturday before the Oscars. The Oscars on the 14th. We'll do it Saturday on the 13th. So look for announcements on that and a link coming really soon from us.
And now that this year, the winner of the Cinephiles Awards is going to get a full Cinephiles deep dive, I am super excited about this.
Yeah, I mean, depending on the timing, Steve, we may be doing two films that break our 10-year record within this year. I don't know how that's going to work out, but we might be doing that as well.
And I actually find this to be a very, very interesting year for Best Picture nominations. So I'm really excited to have some of these conversations.
Well, listen, the way we've done this in the past, for those of you who've been longtime fans, you know we do it like one movie at a time. But this year we decided to do it differently. We're going to group movies together to have conversations about them so you guys can consume them in one sitting. We just thought it was the better way to go about it. And our advisory board, Steve, we just met with them yesterday. They 100% co-signed this approach. So we're going to do three movies, and then four movies to wrap up the process of talking about all 10 of these films. And today we're going to talk about F1, Hamnet, and Marty Supreme. Anyway, we're here to start, and our first conversation will be on F1, this film that was nominated, to a lot of people's surprise, honestly, for Best Picture, directed by Joseph Kosinski, who came off of Top Gun Maverick, written by Aaron Kruger. And this one, of course, starred Brad Pitt, Damson Idris, Carrie Condon, Tobias Menzies, and Javier Bardem, with cinematography from Claudio Miranda and score by Hans Zimmer. And it is a film about F1, this racing, type of racing that has become a massive deal globally over the last few years, and a pretty incredible film overall, made over $600 million worldwide for Apple TV. And this is the biggest film Apple has ever released, and it's got all kinds of love and all kinds of recognition all overboard. National Board of Review gave it one of the top 10 films of the year for themselves as well. So, Steve, what are your thoughts overall on F1, the movie?
You know what's funny? I am absolutely thrilled that this was nominated for Best Picture. I really am. I mean, I haven't gone through, I know there are other films that didn't get nominated and some things that people think were snubs, but I mean, this for me is like part of the philosophy of the Cinephiles, which is you and I never, ever wanted to privilege artsy fartsy movies over comedies or dramas over action films. To me, a great film is a great film. Yeah. And one of the problems with the Oscars has been this weird split between movies that made money and movies that were nominated for Academy Awards. And here we have a extremely, in my opinion, well-crafted, very popular film that a whole bunch of people watched. And so I'm thrilled that this was nominated for Best Picture. Would I vote for it for Best Picture? Absolutely not. But did I like it a lot? I totally did.
Yeah. I mean, this one, as I said, starring Brad Pitt as a racing driver, Sonny Hayes, who returns after a 30-year absence to save his former teammates' underdog team, APXG, from collapse. And he trains a young kid to learn about the business. And that's who Damson Idris plays. I agree with you. I thought this was a fantastic movie. Thoroughly surprised how much I enjoyed it. I do think it stumbles a bit in the middle, which is why I also agree with you. I would not vote for it for Best Picture, but I'm very happy that it got nominated for Best Picture. And I saw some people get really upset about this. Some artsy fartsy critics get really upset about this. And I just felt like telling them to go jump in a lake, because this kind of stuff is really important to recognize. And
yeah,
to someone said like dad cinema. And yes, that's important. Dad cinema is just as important as your artsy fartsy black box one act play cinema. I mean, you have to create space for all of it. F1 certainly does it. And this isn't like F1 is like just some populist film. This was actually a damn good movie with some really good performances here from Brad Pitt, some emotional terrain that we haven't seen him navigate in quite some time. It introduced a lot of people to Damson Idris, who there are rumors he might be the next Black Panther. That's a hell of a thing that he's stepping into. And I think Carrie Condon acquitted herself incredibly well in a film like this. You would not expect her to be cast in a film like this because she does a lot of artsy fartsy stuff. But she worked really well here, and I thought Javier Bardem was a lot of fun throughout this movie as well. And the journey it took us on, seeing what this guy is dealing with, and a lot of people who grew up and are around that age of Brad Pitt in this movie connect to what he's going through, connect to possibly the shots they had when they were younger and didn't quite make it happen. What are their lives like now? And they have to, at times, navigate their life now, helping someone else try to pursue their dreams. So I thought it really did. It really told that story well, and also elevated F1 and made it look amazing for people who want to maybe get into the sport. So it satisfied both things as a movie.
I totally agree. And it's so funny. There were several movies this year that I went in to see them knowing very little and had the wonderful joy throughout the entire film of not really knowing where it was going to go. Like, yeah. I have a very developed story sense. And so when I see a thing introduced in a movie, I go like, I see what you're doing. And yeah. I didn't for many, many movies. F1, on the other hand, is the kind of a movie where you know exactly what you're going to see. Yes, mm-hmm. there are definitely some twists, some surprises along the way, but you know where you're heading. And you know what? That's great, too. Sometimes it's really satisfying to go into a movie and go, I'm going to get this. And then to get it. You know, like, and this is, you know, and this is what always bugs me about the, you know, artist versus popular argument is to me, it's all about degree of difficulty. To me, it's all about, you know, I love craftsmanship. I like people who work hard to make something really good.
Yeah.
And if you're working hard to make something really good and it happens to be about an F1 driver, that's great. And honestly, technically, this is in particular, because guess what? I know nothing about F1. Not only have I watched zero F1, I've watched essentially zero racing. I've never, ever watched it at all. I was sucked into this film immediately. It explained and made clear exactly what was going on. I really understood it. And so for me, a non-F1 fan, I went, man, this is pretty cool. And the other thing about this I found really interesting, Brad Pitt has an interesting career, because Brad Pitt starts off unbelievable movie star looks, unbelievable movie star charisma. But if you look at his career, he is over and over again chosen not to do the big budget star turn action superhero, whatever it is thing. He has done, you know, all sorts of peculiar movies, movies with Quentin Tarantino, movies with odd characters, movies with fight clubs, movies that are challenging. Yeah. You know, did Michael Ritchie movies, you know, he did all that stuff. And so like seeing him come in to do what is a big budget mainstream dad movie, he is so perfectly cast. Like I would say like Brad Pitt, I like Brad Pitt a lot, but he has a wheelhouse where his particular wry sense of humor, I'm a little smarter than the guy next to me, I don't entirely play by the rules, you can't quite get a handle on what I'm thinking, that Brad Pitt thing works perfectly. It's perfectly, I don't know if this movie was written for him, but it sure feels like it. That's my impression. He's just perfectly cast in this film.
Yeah, I would agree with you 100%. And this, as I said earlier, this is emotional terrain that he doesn't get to navigate often in these movies. And yes, it's in a framework of a attempt to be a tentpole film. There's a sequel coming. Jerry Bruckheimer produced this movie, has said there's a sequel coming. So clearly they want this to be a franchise and they want to stay in business with F1, which has become a massive sport, a massive global brand. So what do? You make people connect through the story of what Sonny is going through, which is a guy who had had a shot at everything when he was younger. He blew it, or a guy caught up in his emotions on it, or just in the end, it didn't work out, whatever the reasons are. And now he's got to navigate and confront all these feelings and confront the losses, but still find a way to have his own strength and have his power in his life, reclaim where he wants to go in his life. But he's going to do it on his terms. And I think that's what's great about the movie is they showed you a man who is still who he is, and he's going to navigate the situation exactly how he is, but he's also going to realize some of these moments and mistakes that he made in the past. He doesn't want this young kid to do them, but he's going to make this kid look at what's happening. He is not going to give in to the young kid. He's going to make the kid see these things that are happening so that he doesn't make the same mistakes. And so I think there's something really interesting in that, something almost meta in that, I would imagine, for anybody who's on a set with Brad Pitt, who's a younger actor coming up, that Brad Pitt can help him navigate through those times. Because it wasn't like Brad Pitt's been hitting blockbuster after blockbuster after blockbuster. He's had a lot of trouble, both on screen and off screen, if you want to bring up the Angelina Jolie stuff. So there's a lot around this performance that I thought was really grounded and soulful and touching and connected to someone like me, who's in my 50s, looking back on my life and the mistakes I made when I was younger and things that they could have gone, that I enjoyed about this with his performance. But he stayed who he was, and I thought that was essential. There wasn't some kind of therapist who walked him to this illuminating moment. No, he realized these things as he was experiencing them and finally confronting them. And then by the end, he goes off to do exactly what he does, which is like a gunslinger. This film is almost like a Western, Steve.
Totally, totally. It's a stranger comes to town and fixes everything up. This is the man with no name. 100% that's what it is. Well, I think that's a great analogy because you think about Yojimbo and you think about the man with no name, and it's always this person who is somewhat mysterious and always has a plan. And you're always going, what are they doing? Why are they doing this? But you know that they know why they're doing this. And this is one of the things I love about the movie is, you know, I like intelligence and I like. And so what this movie is this is the old man with the world of experience who understands the game in a profound way. He understands it so well that he's going to play outside the rules because what it really is inside the rules. He understands every little trick and he's going to school the young man. So first of all, I love movies with intelligence. Mm-hmm. As like you said, as a guy in my 50s, seeing the old guy come in and school the young guy is always, that's my kind of story. And it always has been. I love showing that stuff. And I also think, and it occurred to me as you were speaking, it makes a lot of sense that this is the guy that did Top Gun Maverick because what it is like Top Gun Maverick is there's Tom Cruise. Mm. There's the Tom Cruise I love. I knew that and not that Tom Cruise hasn't done other big movies and stuff like that. Obviously he has, but Top Gun Maverick recaptured a thing that we loved about this actor that we hadn't really got to see. And it really goes to the Bruckheimer of it all. Is like, there was a time when you saw Simpson Bruckheimer or just Bruckheimer, it's like, oh, this is going to be a good time. Is it going to be deep? Not necessarily. Is it going to be incredibly moving and sophisticated? Not necessarily. Is it going to deliver the stuff that it intends to deliver? Yeah. And so like having this was this moment of going, there's Brad Pitt. Like this, he always had this in his wheelhouse, but we didn't, no one provided a movie or he didn't pick a movie where he could do this thing in this particular mainstream way. It's not him killing the Manson family while on LSD. You know, that's not that there's anything wrong with that, but that's a different, that has a different energy. It doesn't just have the yes kind of feeling that F1 has.
I agree. And when you look at Damson Idris, who was going toe to toe with Brad Pitt throughout the movie, I thought he acquitted himself really well, especially for a lot of people who maybe are meeting, as I said earlier, Damson Idris for the first time. I thought he gave as good as he got. I thought he reflected a lot of the energy of the younger generation that's going around now with elements that felt universal to every younger generation. They always think the old guys don't know enough. They always think the old guys' tactics aren't the right way to go. They're too caught up in their tradition. But some things work because all the time because they consistently work because they're right. And so to see him bouncing off of that and finding his own way and going down his own path and dealing with an agent, dealing with his people, dealing with his team as they have ulterior motives or they have things going on as well. So he's got to go on his journey. The stuff with his mom, which I think is really great and funny. Like, there's a lot he has to confront himself. And I think a film like this in the past would have given his story short shrift and would have focused much more on the Brad Pitt story overall. But I think he gets a lot of screen time to show you what he can do and his journey that he's on, so that by the end, when they come back together to do the things that they do, it is absolutely both of them getting something really meaning deep and powerful out of the experience and learning from each other, which I think was great as well.
I totally agree. I mean, it's not exactly Hoosiers with the old guy that nobody trusts coming into the town and eventually winning them over to his way of approaching the game of basketball. But it definitely has some of those elements to it, you know, of and trying to figure out exactly what he's doing. And I see something else, which is so in my brain, I've seen Javier Bardem in many, many movies. One of the great actors, has an incredible range, does all sorts of stuff. But frankly, my first real experience of Javier Bardem, and what, although I had seen him in things before, what will be burned into my consciousness forever is No Country for Old Men. So in my brain, whenever I hear the name, that is the first place my brain goes to. This unbelievably terrifying, very sort of quiet and slow and intense killer.
Yeah.
Seeing him have so much fun in this movie was a joy, because Javier Bardem's smile when he's stressed, when he's frustrated with Sonny, when he's loving what's happening, just all of that stuff, it's just great to watch him doing it.
Yeah, I agree. I 100% agree with you. So he's having such a blast and relaxed, and these are things that you see in his Spanish films when he get, like the one that was a couple of years ago where he played the former boss or the boss that was coming into the factory. There was a lot more of a relaxed performance amidst a very stressful situation. I thought he nailed that. So you're right, to see him get to do some of that on the American side of things, which he rarely gets a chance to do, is so much fun to experience here in this movie. And I thought Kerry Condon was damn good. As I said, you don't normally see her in a tentpole film like this. You know, Banshees of Inisherin, she was in Rome, all these other films, but you get to see a little bit more of her personality. If you watch Carrie in interviews, she's so relaxed and funny and doesn't take anything seriously. And so to see her have that kind of element here in the film, and she doesn't take any shit from anybody. She's clear about what she's doing. She's clear about where she's going. Do I think the romance is a little rushed, or they're getting together, it isn't quite as laid out as strongly as it should have been? Sure. But I like them together, and I like that she owns her own property, or real estate rather, in the film, and is not one that's just kind of being like bowled over by Sonny Hayes or being doe-eyed about him, which I really appreciate.
Yeah, I like her too. I like her character. I like kind of the way they frame her. I agree 100%. And this goes into one of the reasons why I would not vote for this for Best Picture. I was not emotionally involved in their relationship.
Yeah.
I was just and now they have a relationship. Okay, that's fun. You know, it's like, it was fun to see them together, but it didn't really make a big difference. And also, you know what? It's kind of like a subset of the thing that I was saying at the beginning of not wanting to privilege one genre of film over another. The idea that actors should stay in their lane. Oh, you do arty films. Oh, you do comedy. Oh, you do this, has been disproven over and over and over again. And I know you feel this, like, I don't want to do just heavy movies on the cinephiles.
Like
you and I are capable of talking about many different things.
Yep.
I am capable of writing or directing in different genres, and you are capable of acting in different genres. And if you're not successful switching over to a genre, then you don't get to do that again. But the idea that someone should, as I said, stay in their lane is the antithesis of artistic expression. And so I'm thrilled when actors who did different stuff show up and have a great time and nail what is required for this kind of movie, you know? Yeah.
And speaking of nailing it, we should, before we finish, wrap up our conversation here, we should give some love to the cinematographer and the editor here, cinematography, Claudio Miranda, and the editing, Stephen Marioni, because the editing was nominated for an Academy Award as well. I had a chance to interview one of the stunt coordinators on the film, Luciano Bacchetta, which is on my channel. And that was so much fun to find out more about how they put these races together, about how they choreograph stuff, about where Joseph Kaczynski placed the cameras in the car, how they created new cameras or new styles of cameras to shoot the action that they did and edit it in a way that was just utterly thrilling in all of these races. That's really the biggest thing as far as promoting F1 that the film did is it made it look incredible so that you want to give it a chance if you've never seen anything like this.
No, 100%. And well, and this is, again, the things that people don't talk about. Yeah. F1 is a visceral experience.
Yeah.
When those 100%. Races are going on with that sound and the way that it's put together and the shot selection, you're just in, 100% in. And again, this is not the same as a beautiful Shakespearean monologue, which will happen in another movie we're talking about. It's not the same as a heartfelt weeping performance. It's not the same of having, you know, intellectual themes about the meaning of life. But the craftsmanship to create a visceral race experience is just as hard to do as any of that other stuff.
Yeah, agreed. Agreed. But what are your thoughts as we wrap up here? What are your thoughts on Joseph Kosinski as a director on this? I mean, he's just Top Gun Maverick. F1, the movie, and moving on to do a couple of other projects here that have been announced and being worked on. So what's your feeling on this guy and his work here in this movie?
So he's also Tron Legacy and Oblivion, correct?
Yes. Yes.
So if you had asked me after those two movies, I would have said, man, this guy has amazing visual style. And I was completely bored in both movies, you know? And so I think what I think that I'm seeing is a filmmaker that has grown since 2010. Yeah. And if, you know, between Top Gun Maverick and this, I'm in, dude. What are you going to make for us next? I'm excited.
Yeah, I'm curious to see what's next as well. I would throw in another movie that I think is the bridge movie that showed that he was growing as a director. And if you guys haven't seen it, it's a firefighter movie called Only the Brave. That's such a damn good, quietly damn good small movie that more people should take a look at and see. I think Josh Brolin and I can't remember who else was in that film, but Miles Teller, I think, is in that film. It's an incredible exploration of a real thing that happened in a wildfire in California to these firefighters. So I highly recommend people watch that because you'll see that he's beginning to get to Top Gun Maverick and F1 in that movie. So I agree with you, Steve. After those first two films, you're like, yeah, these are pretty films, but you're not quite nailing the emotion or the story here. I'm not as invested. Now through Only the Brave and into these two films, I think we've got ourselves potentially a incredible auteur down the road as he does more of these films that we will talk about, I'm sure, on the Cinephiles in years to come, for sure.
Two other quick things. One is that, by the way, Oblivion is written by my most famous writing friend, Carl Gajdoszczyk, who I went to high school with. And nice. He's the very first thing I ever directed was a play written by Carl Gajdoszczyk. That's who wrote Oblivion. Wow. So, the other thing I wanted to say is just a totally non-film thing, non-Oscar thing. It is a business thing. Boy, Apple was smart to buy the rights to F1.
Yeah.
So that they're now the official broadcasters of that when this movie is coming along. That was a hell of a smart business move.
Yeah. I mean, Apple's known for making a lot of smart
Yeah, they make some moves. Good choices, those guys.
They do.
Hey, everyone. This is John from the Cinephiles here to talk to you about Quince. You know, this time of year always makes me rethink what I have in my closet, and I'm trying to keep fewer things, but better ones, pieces that are well-made and easy to wear all the time. And that's why I keep coming back to Quince. The fabrics feel elevated, the fits are thoughtful, and the pricing actually makes sense. Quince makes high-quality everyday essentials using premium materials like 100% European linen and their insanely soft flow-knit activewear fabric. Their men's linen pants and shirts are lightweight, breathable, and comfortable, basically the perfect layer for spring, and their flow-knit activewear, moisture-wicking, anti-odor, and soft enough that you'll actually want to wear it all day. I recently made a purchase of the flow-knit hoodie, and I just couldn't believe how lightweight and breathable and soft and comfortable it felt. And it's true. I literally didn't realize I was wearing it all day until I lay down on my couch about 8 o'clock and realized I still had it on. That's how amazing these products from Quince really are. And the best part is that their prices are 50 to 60% less than similar brands. How? Well, they work directly with ethical factories and they cut out the middlemen. So you're paying for quality, not brand markup. Refresh your wardrobe with Quince. Go to quince.com/cinephiles for free shipping and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. Go to quince.com/cinephiles for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/cinephiles. Tell them John and Steve sent you.
All right, well, that's our thoughts on F1, both the good stuff and some of the stuff that we felt held it back from being the picture that Steve and I would vote for Best Picture. Let's move on to another film, Steve, and this one is quite a change of pace from F1. This one is Hamnet, directed by Chloe Zhao, fresh off some of the mixed reactions to Eternals. This one stars Jesse Buckley, Paul Mescal, Emily Watson, and Joel Alwyn, with Paul Mescal playing the bard himself, William Shakespeare, and Jesse Buckley playing his wife, Agnes. And it basically tells the story through, based on this book written by Maggie O'Farrell, about the death of their son and how it motivated Shakespeare to create Hamlet. But we see the pain and the journey of this loss through this incredible wood spirit, is what I would say, Agnes, played by Jesse Buckley. What are your thoughts overall on this movie, Steve? What did you think about, what did you feel about Hamlet?
I think this is a very powerful film. It's funny. So I knew the basic idea. Like, I knew, okay, this is about the relationship. This is about the son. This is the son's death, and it inspires Hamlet. There was no way to expect what this movie actually is. You know what I mean? And part of it, I would say, is that I had, because what's the most important thing in this movie? Well, obviously, it's William Shakespeare and Hamlet, one of the great plays of all time. And so I am going, in my brain, this is like a biopic, an origin story, and it's not. What this is a film, it's not that Hamlet and Shakespeare are incidental to the film. They aren't. They're very important, and particularly as you move towards the end, towards that incredibly moving ending.
Yeah.
But really, this is a story about this woman and about child rearing and about this time and about the culture and about a very unique and very painful emotional experience. It is so much its own film. And I found it just, I was completely engrossed in it the whole time.
Yeah. This is in my top three of the films of 2025. It was a devastatingly amazing watch for me.
Yeah.
There was so much that I took from this movie. You know this, Steve, and those of you who listen to us for a long time, you know, I'm a massive Shakespeare person. He's a very important person in my life. When I got into acting, when I got into theater, studied in London, studied under a couple of teachers who taught at the RSC, the Royal Shakespeare Company. Truly an honor to have experienced all of that. And it gave me a lifelong appreciation for the work of Shakespeare. But as Steve said, Shakespeare and the play Hamlet are not necessarily the focus of this movie. It is about Agnes, who is essentially Anne Hathaway, his first wife, her journey as this ethereal person who almost seems to come out of the ground of the forest and make a decision to be part of the human world, to acquiesce to how the humans do things. She connects with William Shakespeare, marries him, has this relationship, and has children with him. And so we see her as this fierce mother. And then this thing happens to her, to their son, Hamnet, played by Noah Jupe, who's fantastic in the movie.
Oh, yeah.
And what he experiences and the death of their son, the way he dies is devastating, is selfless and gorgeous and beautiful. But what it does to her, what it does to Shakespeare as they navigate this, because Shakespeare, in essence, is almost like an absentee dad because he's out there trying to make his living in the world. And so we're seeing what she deals with, how she navigates this, how she deals with this pain and all the things that are connected with it. And it is amazing to watch this performance. She's the odds-on favorite to win Best Actress, and I think she thoroughly deserves it. She's an incredible dynamo. I think those of us who've been watching her for a while, we knew this was eventually going to happen. And she just owns this film from beginning to end. But the story that's being told and the thing that's happening to her, I love the last 30 to 40 minutes of the movie when we get to the play where you see that this is not a person who's like honored by what William has done at the beginning of the play. She is horrified that her trauma is being played out on stage for others to experience. And it's the gorgeous writing and the construction of the play that softens her heart and makes her reconnect with William after having that connection broken because of the death of their son. It's an incredible film, bro. Just beautifully done, you know?
I totally agree. You know what I was saying about F1, where there are movies where you know where they're going to go and they give you what you want and that makes you happy. And then there are movies where you really don't know where it's going to go. And what's interesting about this is I knew from the description what I said. It's Shakespeare and his wife and their kid dies, and Hamlet. So I know those signposts. I know the kid is going to die. Yeah. I know we're going to end up with the play Hamlet. And yet, even as we're in the middle of the play, even as Hamlet is there, I don't know what's going to happen. Yeah. And what I mean is it's I don't know emotionally what's going to happen. I don't know what I'm going to feel. Or more specifically, I don't know what she is going to feel.
Yeah.
And she is both one of the fascinating and most, in a weird way, alien characters in a film I've ever seen. It's like, because it's just as you described, like she emerges from the earth. Like this is a person of a pre-Christian way of looking at reality. Yes. I mean, she really is. And and everyone talks about her, that she's a witch, that her mother was a witch. And she knows these spells and these herbs and these things that you think of as Christian civilized thing. These this is from the old world, and being in her world. Cause this is her movie. This is not William Shakespeare's movie. Even though you start with him and you see him spot her and, you know, obviously be drawn to her, but really we stick with her. And man, the scenes of childbirth and the scene of the death are among the most real, honest, gut-wrenching, powerful. They just wrecked me. They absolutely. Yeah. And in the moment, I mean, I guess that, you know, we should have said this is a spoiler review.
Yeah.
You know, I won't go into too much details. But there is a moment when young Hamnet does a thing with his sister.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, oh my, it's that moment where the window opens up and you know what's going to happen, because it's been set up so perfectly in terms of her prophecy and her how she has seen into the future, and you just go, oh no. And then from that point forward, or even from earlier forward, there is just this feeling of dread, and there's something I think terribly human about this film.
Yeah.
This, you know, so even though we're talking about literally the most famous writer in the history of possibly the world, certainly the most famous and beloved writer in the English language, this is a very human, down-to-earth story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it kind of breaks the mythology of the hero worship with Shakespeare, right? There was another film a couple of years ago from Kenneth Branagh called All Is True, which I really enjoyed, and showcased Shakespeare coming back to live with Anne Hathaway, played by the Dame Judi Dench in the film, and live his life out there as an older person before he passes on. And it also worked on destroying this myth of Shakespeare as being this iconic, untouchable, unknowable type of entity and, awe-inspiring. There's much more realism in that movie that I really enjoyed. So this approach to telling a story, Steve, you're absolutely right. I thoroughly enjoy it as well. I like that Agnes is not someone that we're necessarily going to connect to or gravitate to, because she is at times abrasive. She is demanding. She is pushy. She's not willing to necessarily concede certain things in a human existence or a human society. She fights back. She owns her agency and her estate where she's at in terms of her physicalness that is very strong and powerful. And it turns other people off, including William's parents at times, which I think was important. So that when we're on this, but we start to care about her because of what she experiences with the kids, because of how much of a fierce mother she is, how protective she is. And when she confronts the loss of her son, that is something that is supremely devastating. And I think makes it very universal at a time when we're being much more open in talking about trauma and the trauma of loss, for better or worse. We're much more open talking about it. I think this film captures this at the right time, captures this energy at the right time. And we follow her on this journey as she navigates this, so that when she gets to that moment at the end of the play, where she understands what William is doing in honor of her son, I've seen the film 3 times now. I cry every time when she cries, like every time, because Jesse's performance is so visceral that you feel that in your bones. If you've ever experienced loss, what it's like to finally say goodbye to the thing you lost, to finally accept that it is gone. And that is just an amazing moment in the movie. And I can't speak more positively about it than I just did right now, you know?
What's so interesting, you know, I started by saying that this really isn't, it's not a biopic about Shakespeare. It's not an origin story of Hamlet. And yet in that scene, and I agree with you, that sequence at the end is so powerful, is this movie is, after this very human story, takes us to the healing power of art. It takes us to the, this is why art is important.
Yes.
And I don't think that Agnes understood that art was important until she is there and goes and understands that there is some transformation, some transubstantiation of her spirit by watching this play in this moment, which is how I feel about art. You could have that moment where you're there and you're like, oh, I'm not the same person walking out of the, I mean, how do we deal with sorrow? How do we deal with pain? Yeah. How do we deal with all the loss and pain in life? Well, one of the ways is through art, you know, that's how we express it. That's how we expose it. That's how we feel it in public, you know? And this play just brings that home. So even though it's not about Shakespeare, in the end, it says, this is why this matters, you know?
And I have to say, normally I like to find certain things to, you know, what didn't work, what didn't work. There is very little that doesn't work in this movie. I mean, I just don't know that there's much that I could talk about that doesn't work. I love the cinematography from Lucas Zhao. I like the music here by Max Richter and the direction from Chloe Zhao. This is a completely different person from the thing I saw in Eternals, which to me was a mishmash and a mess. This is a film that is staged so wonderfully. The angles that she uses, the moments to choose, she chooses to go in close-ups, the set locations. I mean, that massive tree out in the forest, all of that that we see, the construction of Shakespeare's village at that time, but then also the construction of the globe. And then that sequence, as I talk about with Hamlet, what happens near the end of the movie, the way that is shot, the way they remove sound. I mean, just so many smart decisions as a director by Chloe Zhao that makes this film just, to use another trans word, transcendental when you watch it, because it does take you to a completely different place. And it is so effective in doing so.
Yeah, it's funny. I hated Eternals. I watched it over three nights with many cocktails. And the whole time I'm going like, I don't understand what's happening. I don't know who, I don't know what these characters want. You know, it's like, because like I said, I'm pretty good with figuring out a story. And I'm watching, I'm going like, wait, why is that character doing that thing? And maybe it was the cocktails that was making me a little bit fuzzier. But mostly I was like, what the hell is this? And it really makes me go, what was the journey that got to that movie? Because this is an unbelievably brilliant director with a unique and powerful vision of how she wants to make films. Yeah. And my assumption is that Marvel wouldn't let her. Like, I really want to know what was the, and it doesn't, it, that doesn't mean, by the way, because I say someone is a brilliant director, that I'm going to like every movie they make.
Yeah.
But the thing, when I, you know, I want to see Chloe Zhao's movies, you know, I don't, you know, like, and I will show up and I will watch and maybe I will like it or maybe I won't, but I want her vision because she is a visionary. And then you go like, okay. And with the big Marvel, you know, machine, it feels like that movie crushed a visionary. I don't know. I don't know behind the scenes, but that's how it feels.
Yeah. I think for every, you know, Ryan Coogler in Marvel, there are two or three directors who come from independent movies who can't make that transition. You know, the first Captain Marvel movie, those two directors, I can't remember their names right now, not that strong of what they did. Chloe Zhao, I think, as well, having issues with Eternals. And then recently with the Marvels, right? What happened there with Nia DaCosta. So not everyone can make that jump. Not everyone can make that move. And it must be very hard to try to have your own artistic vision within a framework of something that needs to be populist. It must be very difficult. So this, I think, was an essential cleanse, I would imagine, for Chloe Zhao to go back to the things that made people love her work and want her to get, and want Marvel to hire her to do something like Eternals. And this film is nominated for 8 Academy Awards, Steve. Best Original Score, Production Design, Costume Design, Casting, which is that new category, Best Adapted Screenplay, Actress, Director, and Best Picture. I know everyone thinks it might be One Battle Left or Another or Sinners, but if this pulls a Shakespeare in Love upset, I would be so incredibly happy in the end, because I do think it is the most complete film of all the films that are nominated for Best Picture, in my opinion, because as I just said a few minutes ago, I had a really hard time finding any flaws in this movie. The problem is, I think the movie is not something that a majority of people are necessarily going to gravitate to and feel as powerfully as those of us who the movie works for, you know? And I think in the end, they'll go for either Sinners or One Battle After Another, but I would not be mad if this wins Best Picture.
I mean, I like to see, you know, it's funny. Like, I agree with you. I think that's what's going to happen. It's going to be one of those two. And there is, you know, there is a thing of certain kinds of movies when they're really, really successful, in my opinion, feel more Best Picture-like, you know? Like, Lawrence of Arabia is a Best Picture kind of movie, you know? You know,
yes.
Oppenheimer is a Best Picture kind of movie. And Sinner, both Sinners and One Battle After Another fill that requirement a little more than this does, whereas this is a small movie. I don't mean that in a condescending way.
Right.
This is an intimate movie. This is a very specific movie about a very specific time and place, very specific character. Yeah. And not everyone, and maybe not everyone will, you know, jive with it. You know, it's not going to work for everybody. But I'm with you. This is a great film. And if a great film wins Best Picture, I'm going to be cool with that.
Absolutely. And I will say one last thing as we wrap up, Steven, we'll get your final thoughts on it as well. I have seen Hamlet done 5 million times in my life, both on screen and on stage and on the small screen, right? To make Hamlet come back alive for me in a way that I've never seen before is an incredible accomplishment. And I thought this film did that. Those last 30 minutes of the movie where they essentially gave you the cliff notes of Hamlet, it was incredible how they still, Chloe Zhao and Maggie O'Farrell's screenplay and book still captured the power of that play. And as you said, Steve, the importance of art, the fact that it brought it back to life for me in a way that I've never experienced it before speaks volumes of how great this movie is, almost meta in that way and how it's showing you through its art, why art is so powerful for everyone else who's also gone through a journey of processing trauma through a play or a film or a piece of music or anything like that, that is art connected for themselves. And I think that's another positive about this movie and Chloe Zhao's direction.
I completely agree. And well, this is why I actually really think, I really like this slate of Best Pictures this year because there are a lot of movies where it's like, yeah, this is this movie. This is this director's vision. This is the story they wanted to tell. Yeah. And I'm here for it, you know?
Yeah.
And I agree with you. Like the fact that it could have such reverence for Shakespeare, do it so well, do it so beautifully, and actually be a story about this completely different thing. And the most spectacular, amazing human in this story, in fact, is not William Shakespeare.
Yeah.
It's Agnes, you know?
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
I agree 100%. All right, so that's our thoughts on this incredible film from Chloe Zhao, Hamlet, which I think a lot of people feel might be a dark horse for Best Picture. We'll see. And we'll see where it ends up in our voting, our Cinephiles Award shows, when the voting happens for that as well. Now, let's move on to our next film, Steve, here. And this is Marty Supreme, a sports comedy drama from director Josh Safdie of the Safdie brothers. You know, both Safdie brothers released sports movies last year, but this is the one that got a lot of attention here that stars Timothy Chalamet as table tennis player Marty Mauser. It's set in the 1950s, and it follows his quest to become a world champion. It stars Gwyneth Paltrow, Odessa Azion, Kevin O'Leary, Abel Ferrara, and Fran Drescher as well, and Tyler O'Conma. So, Steve, your thoughts on this movie here, 2.5-hour movie here from Josh Safdie, a 1950s exploration of a ping pong player. Your thoughts?
Well, first of all, ping pong has really needed a resurgence in the sports film world, and I'm very happy. Sure. I'm here for it. I thought, it's funny, you said it's a 2.5-hour movie. I think this movie flies along. I think it is thrilling in its way.
Yeah.
And Chalamet, I mean, it's like, it's so funny going like, that. Here's this guy that just explodes.
Yeah.
And at this moment, he kind of can do no wrong. I mean, he is an incredible actor. His performance is great. So I like this movie a lot, despite the fact I don't like Marty Supreme that much, but I like the film. The character is troubling, but the movie is good.
Yeah, Marty Mauser, Marty Supreme is the character, and it's based on Marty Reisman, who wrote a memoir in 1974, The Money Player, The Confessions of America's Greatest Table Tennis Champion and Hustler. And by the way, Josh Safdie offered this role to Chalamet back in 2018, and they didn't even get it greenlit till 2024. So that shows you, hey, Steve, you know this, it shows you how Hollywood works. These projects sometimes are gestating for a very long time before they finally come to fruition and get all the attention. But a lot of these creatives, both in front of and behind the camera, sometimes are along for this process for a long time before they finally get a chance to see what the film turns out to be.
It's so funny. I think this to me tells you a lot about how Hollywood business, Hollywood executives work, and two different mind frames, because I can imagine the pitch. Yeah, we're going to do a period piece ping pong movie. It's going to need a pretty big budget. A lot of sets. Of course, we use all sorts of computer effects to do the games.
Yeah.
So what do you think? And the studio goes, ping pong? Are you kidding? Nobody is interested in that. And right. I think that's, and then there's the executive that goes, that is so bizarre. That is exactly what people are going to be interested in.
Right.
It's not, it's the whole skating to where the puck is going. I'm not saying the puck was going to ping pong movies, but it's saying here's something different. And the movie totally, totally is.
Yeah, and I think it's fascinating, too, when you look at how the timing of the movie. I think the, how can I say this? The development of Timothée Chalamet as an actor and then the public's growing fascination with Timothée Chalamet as an actor, it hit at the right time.
Yeah.
The Safdie brothers had established themselves with Uncut Gems, and so people were looking forward to see what they were going to do next. The breakup happened, so Josh is able to focus on doing this thing himself, and you get Gwyneth Paltrow coming back, who we haven't seen act in a lot over the last few years other than Marvel films, and I think she delivers one of the best performances of her career, and she's an Oscar-winning actress herself from Shakespeare in Love. So the chemistry they have together as they navigate this relationship of theirs, I think, is utterly fascinating. And Odessa Azion is a new actress coming through. She is the daughter of Pamela Adlon, and she's fantastic in her role as well in this movie. So there's a lot of good performances throughout this film. And then Kevin O'Leary, Mr. Fantastic, whatever his name is, I think he does an incredible job in the film, considering I never knew this guy could act, because the only thing I've ever seen him act on is on Shark Tank. So it's insane to see how these disparate elements came together to create this movie.
It's so weird, by the way. So I have never watched a single episode of Shark Tank, but I had seen, on Instagram, I'd go by and there I would see his face. And I'm watching the movie. I didn't realize who that was. Other than I kept going like, this is like a reality guy or a news guy or a son. I couldn't really remember as I'm watching the movie. And my whole experience, he is so good in the movie.
Yeah.
I don't have any statement about how good an actor or what his range is, but that character sits in the sweet spot for that dude, in a very particular way. And he is also, here's what I'll say, because I'm trying to figure out how to bring this together, is that, what I was saying, the difference between F1 and Hamnet, where in F1, I knew where the movie was going to go, and I was really happy to go there. Right. Hamnet, even though I knew a little bit about what it was supposed to be about, I had no way to expect how that movie would unfold.
Right.
The same is true with Marty Supreme. It turns in every conceivable direction, and I think the Kevin O'Leary part is a perfect example of, what is happening with this person? What is this relationship? And then when it gets to where it gets to, where he finally needs to humiliate Marty Supreme, and it's just like, I don't know, it is a continually surprising movie.
Yes, absolutely. And no more so than Chalamet's performance. A lot of people think he's the odds-on favorite to win Best Actor, although Michael B. Jordan winning at the SAG Awards might put that a little bit more into question. What did you think of his performance throughout this movie as maybe a career turner to go into even bigger things now at this point in his career?
I mean, I don't see a crack in Chalamet. Like the hype is deserved. He is a great actor. But to go from Dune to A Complete Unknown to this, three totally different parts. Each one he completely loses himself in, obviously. Mm-hmm. What you need someone with unbelievable charisma. It's not, I'm not saying that this is the same as Wolf of Wall Street, but you're going to have a character who's going to do some unsavory things.
Right.
And so you need someone with unbelievable charisma and a performance that's endlessly fascinating, or you would reject this guy, you know?
Yeah. I think you're 100% correct. And I would throw a fourth film in there, Wonka, as well. The success, right? The success that making $600 million plus on a Wonka movie. Pretty incredible stuff what he was able to do with that role as well. Distinctly different from the other three films and performances that you mentioned. But Steve, I know we've had conversations about this movie and you kind of hinted at it at the opening of our conversation of this movie, but what are your thoughts on the film and the story of the film, the story of Marty Mauser, what he goes through, the bodies that lie in the wake of Marty Mauser as he has this single-minded determination to become and be recognized as the greatest table tennis player of all time?
So I put it almost into like it's two different parallel movies. Mm. So as a sports film here are the big matches, here are the builds to the big matches, here are the people you have to beat, how it all plays out. This is a great sports movie, and I have a ball. As a character study, like, you just keep going, wow, how terrible a person is this guy? I mean, when they try to blackmail someone over a dog, you know, like, there's some stuff in here. He robs his own store, puts his friend at gunpoint. Like, there's a lot of stuff in this movie where just like, well, and even, you know, he doesn't like where he's supposed to stay, so he just checks into the Ritz and spends $1,500 of money he doesn't have. These are all, you know, you've heard me struggle with these things for the entire history of the Cinephiles. We're watching Goodfellas, watching Wolf of Wall Street, and I'm like, they're great films, but it's like, oh my God, what are you doing? You know?
Yeah, exactly. But I think that's what makes the film such a challenge for the viewer, because he is not a guy who is that likable in terms of actions. But there is, as you said, there's something about the determination to achieve what he wants to achieve, the fact that he's willing to do whatever it takes, almost getting shot, almost getting stabbed, almost dying multiple times, and then and seducing a married woman of a wealthy man who could absolutely destroy him at any moment. He loves to play in the fire. Some people live and breathe in the chaos, and he is absolutely a guy who lives and breathes in the chaos. Yet while you're watching the movie, you find yourself wanting to succeed, even though you don't like the way he's doing things. Like I said, seducing Gwyneth Paltrow, you know, the way he treats his mom, stealing the money, screwing over his friend about the ping pong balls, and then Odessa Azion's character having her get pregnant. But then he like beats up the guy who beat her up. So does he have some sort of nobility there? And then the frustration he feels in going against the Japanese ping pong player who simply just is good at what he does, and it frustrates Marty that he can't beat him. So there's so many things.
Wait, hold on. Yeah. I have to disagree. He is not just simply good at what he does. He has a special, and in Marty's opinion, illegal ping pong paddle. It's like he showed up to the baseball game. Everyone's got wooden bats, and he's got an aluminum bat. Like,
that's a good point.
This is a whole other technique. What one of the things that was so funny, and I don't know, are you much of a ping pong player?
I did when I was younger. We had a ping pong table growing up in my house in Virginia. I haven't played for years, but yeah, I used to play, and in the military too, which was a lot of fun.
Ping pong was a very, very big deal. All of my family, everyone had ping pong tables. There was lots of ping pong. My dad was very good at ping pong.
Yeah.
And I was reading a little bit about Sappy making the movie, and it may be a Jewish thing. It might be that this was a typically Jewish thing. Anyway, the reason I bring it up is I remember when people had good paddles.
Yeah.
Like, there's a total difference between the actual good paddle and the one that's sitting on the table at camp everyone that's been out in the rain, you know? And so like what surprised me in the movie is like Marty, one place that he is honorable in his way is about the game. He refuses to use a spongy paddle, right?
Right. He won't compromise for the game. Right.
Nope.
Yeah.
Everything else will compromise, but not that.
Exactly. What do you think about the scene where he like, where, you know, he basically serves up his butt to be paddled in front of these rich people? I think that's what I like about the film too, is that there's a commentary. Like, it's easy to judge Marty because you go, well, he's doing terrible things. But are you judging him from a place that you didn't grow up in those kinds of conditions, those hard scrabble conditions with a gift? Because we hear about the other stories, right? When you grow up poor, the mother who works five jobs and drives him to the practices, the dad who sacrifices and works three jobs and drives their kid to the practices, stays for hours as they do their ice skating. But this is a different type of hard scrabble story. And he does some nefarious things or some questionable things, morally questionable things, in order to achieve the things he's got to achieve, because he doesn't have that family that's going to drive him to the rink. He doesn't have that family that believes in what he does, or those friends other than the guy who made the ping pong balls for him who believe in what he does. He lives with a bunch of characters and he lives right on the razor's edge of his poverty, but he knows he's built for more. And so how far should he go? Should he not go? Would we be happier if he accepted a simple existence and never pursuing his dreams? I think that's what's great about the movie, is it challenges you to see this, the world, through his points of view and decide if you like what he does or not, or if you can excuse what he does or not. And I think that's, it's kind of brilliant by how they construct the film.
It was funny, when I kind of got derailed, I realized I was jumping to the end of the movie in the scene that you cite, which is him getting spanked in front of all the rich people. I think that scene is amazing because of everything that you've talked about right here, which is, on the one hand, he is fighting against a totally unfair system with no advantages, and he feels like a hero.
Yes.
On the other hand, and the, you know, the rich guy's a jerk. Like, you know, we don't like him at all. So, so this seems terrible. On the other hand, Marty Supreme deserves a spanking, you know, frankly, his behavior is terrible. And so it's like, if he had just, like, could he have gotten the $700 in a way other than robbing his, you know, friend at gunpoint? Right. Maybe he could have, but he didn't need to check into the Ritz.
Right, this is right.
You know what I mean? Like, we could say he's got a hard scrabble life and he's not exactly playing by the rules because the rules don't play for him. And I, like, that's the kind of story. But when you stay at the Ritz, when you steal the dog, when you do the, you know, like, when you do all those things, it's like, you didn't have to do that. And that's what puts you in the shitty situation. It's exactly like, you know, what I know it's silly. It's a silly comparison. But why I get frustrated in Goodfellas, which is, so I'm like, why are you spending this money? You got millions of dollars. You should be able to just go away and live quietly and you're good, but you're not, because they're all stupid, you know? And that's how I feel about Marty Supreme.
Well, what do you feel about Josh Safdie's direction? You mentioned that the 2.5 hours fly by. I agree with you, but what do you think about his direction in the movie and how he presents, like, puts a 1980s score to a 1950s movie, yet still makes it feel like a 1980s sports movie?
I love the choice of the music. I think it works. That's one of those things where when it works great, it's awesome. You know, like, you have a Knight in Shining Armor movie with heavy metal music and you're like, this is exactly what I need. Or Rushmore that has British Invasion music, you know, but the effect that it has, and I think what putting the 80s music in this movie has, is it's almost like it creates what I would call a dynamic period piece, which is that it's the 50s, but it isn't the 50s because it's the 50s driven by 80s music. You know, I think that gives you a different feeling. And you know, kinetic is my word for his direction throughout the whole thing.
Yeah.
Is that you're never gonna quite get your balance. It's always driving forward. You never, as soon as one thing gets solved, three more things pop up, three more conflicts appear. He's scrambling in another direction to do a thing. And because he is not a predictable character, we never know where it's going to go. And this is the other thing about Marty Supreme that I think is great.
Yeah.
We don't 100% ever get to really know what he's thinking or what he's feeling.
You're right. Yeah. Yeah. There's not these, like, quiet moments of reflection. Should I be doing, should I not be doing this? We just see that he has this passionate fire to achieve the things that he wants to achieve. But there is no kind of, it's like we're doing a few good men right now. We just talked about the scene where Kathy is sitting all alone in front of the Arlington Memorial Bridge at night, reconsidering what he needs to do or putting everything together and deciding if he wants to take the case or not. There's none of that with Marty. There is this undeniable belief that he must achieve what he must to achieve. He's a battering ram to achieve these things. And by the end, though, Steve, what's your feeling on the ending? Do you think he's done? Do you think he's now finished? Do you think the things that happen at the end of the movie are like saying, okay, you had your run, you had your moment in the sun, now it's time to just embrace being a normal person in this world?
This is an interesting question because I've only seen the movie once, and I have a feeling my feelings on that moment
will change.
Are going to evolve.
Yeah.
Well, it's because it's kind of, it's not exactly, it's not like the ending of The Graduate, but there is, but it is have a feeling like I don't trust Marty Supreme at all. You know, I don't, my feeling watching it this time was he hasn't changed. He's going to do exactly the same stuff again. Yeah, that was my feeling. What's your feeling at the end?
It's a good question. Even though I asked it, I don't mean to be cocky about it.
Sure, compliment yourself.
I don't mean to say, oh Marty. It's more. I think this go two ways, right? I agree with you in one way that it could go that he hasn't changed, and something else will now be that the thing that he wants to achieve. And he'll say to himself, I have to achieve it because I have a child now and I have a wife now, or I will eventually have a wife now and I've got to provide, right? That's kind of the possibility there at the end. Or this is what happens to a lot of people, right? Ed O'Neill in Married with Children. I was a high school superstar. I could have been.
Yeah.
And they live in that place of like, I tasted greatness once in my life and he'll forever remember that he did it. But will this be a fading memory that he looks back on and wonders what could have been? Or will this be the inspiration to go like, I got this out of my system. I can now relax, settle into a nice life and remember that time fondly rather than thinking about what could have been. So I think there's two interesting ways for me, to me in my mind, where it could go at that ending. And it's like just, it because it leaves you thinking about it.
Well, I mean, if this was Rocky One, just wait for the whole the Martyverse. We're going to have a whole series of these.
Yes, the Japanese champion will call him out, call him a chicken, and do all these kinds of things. And so, it's very possible. So this is nominated for 9 Academy Awards, Steve. Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor, Best Screenplay, Original Screenplay, Best Casting, Best Cinematography, Best Production Design, Best Editing, Best Costume Design. So that's got to tell you that there's quite a lot of people in quite a lot of categories who really like this movie, but there has been some pushback to the film. So what do you feel about any of the criticisms? Do you have any criticisms about this movie?
Some people I don't feel know like what the criticisms are. What is the pushback?
Some people feel like the Abel Ferreira storyline is completely wasted and kind of shoved in and it's unnecessary for the movie. The storyline with him and Penn Jillette, that whole sequence. A lot of people feel that that is unnecessary to be in the movie. What are your thoughts on that? It throws off the rhythm of the film.
I didn't feel that way at all. I was totally involved. I never didn't bump on it even a little bit. If some people had that experience, then, you know, that is what it is. But no, I didn't feel that way. Did you feel that way?
No, not at all. I liked it. First of all, I like Abel Ferreira. He's an unusual cat in a lot of ways in the world of film. I thought the sequence was a lot of fun in terms of like what it shows you about Marty and how it puts Marty in legitimate danger and his girlfriend in legitimate or the woman that he was, you know, having an affair with in legitimate danger in that whole situation. And the way it all plays out, once again, he's a guy who is essentially foraging for what's left off dead people so that he can achieve the things he wants to achieve. So it shows that he's, even in that moment, he's willing to do what he needs to do in order to get to the next thing that he wants to get to. So,
I like that. I mean, that to me is sort of a, when you said there's controversy or something, I'm like, is there some scandal that I don't, you know, like, it's really funny. I think this movie is my second or third choice in most of the categories it's nominated in.
Right.
You know, it's not that I don't think those things are great. It's just, I think the costumes are great. Yeah. I think the costumes in Sinners are amazing. You know what I mean? And I feel like that about a lot of the film. So it's got a ton of nominations, which is fantastic. Yeah, the one is Chalamet, it seems the most likely to win. I think casting is another one because what a great assemblage of interesting people, particularly like Kevin O'Leary. Like, well, that's a cast. Yeah. That's casting, you know, saying that this interesting person can play this part. I think that's one it could get. But no, I don't see this as pulling down a whole bunch of Oscars.
I agree. And I'll have to say that I thought the score not being nominated was a bit of a crime. I like the score. Mm. Daniel Lopatin's score in here was really good. I think it was an essential character in the movie as well. And again, I'll reiterate this battle that I have all the time. I think they should increase the number of nominees per category. It doesn't mean you have to fill every slot, but I think there should be more because there's a lot of great work going on up there that isn't being recognized, even though more movies are qualifying for these categories. So I just feel like it should be expanded so that we can recognize more artists in this way. Any final words here on Marty Supreme as we close the book on this film, Steve?
No, I think this is why I've really enjoyed this year of movies, because we're all over the place. So we were on a racetrack, we were back in Elizabethan England, and now we're in 50s ping pong land. Like, that's great. That's what I want movies to do. I want them to take me to different places and tell me different stories. And so far, I'm really enjoying them.
Agreed. Well, thank you to everyone who's listened to our breakdown of F1, Hamnet, and Marty Supreme. We'll be back with another collection of three movies to talk about, and then we'll do another collection with the last four movies we're going to talk about here on our Oscar series. And as Steve said at the beginning of the show, don't forget, you can vote for the Cinephile Award shows. It's all the categories and nominees are based on the Oscar categories and nominees. You can vote on there at the free tier that you can go onto our Patreon, www.patreon.com/cinephiles, and take a look and sign up for the free tier and vote. And we will have our award show on Saturday, March 13th. Look for that coming very, very soon. For my partner, Steve Morris, I'm John Rocha, and we'll talk to you next time with another installment in our Oscars Best Picture series.